Hello and welcome once again to a stunning episode of the Film Stage Show. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and of course this is the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am joined, as always, by my two wonderful co-hosts, Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hey.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Why, hello.
That was odd.
I didn't mean for that to sound like an offensive Asian stereotype, but that's just how it came out.
All right. You know, we like to keep things controversial here. For anyone just joining us for the first time today, this is how we work. We'll be talking about a discussion topic related to movies or movie news, and then we'll be moving into a feature review. This week, our feature review will be Beasts of the Southern Wild, directed by Ben Zeitlin and starring Kuvenzhané, right? Kuvenzhané Wallace and Dwight Henry. Before we get into any of that, though, I'd like to say, again, you should probably check us out on iTunes. You should probably subscribe to us because we put out a new show every week and you should catch them all. And you should definitely leave us a comment and a review. You should also try to email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com with all of your comments and questions. You never know, we might read them on the air or we might just kind of file them away and never, ever, ever talk about them. But today, our discussion topic, which relates to the movie we were watching pretty heavily, is the concept of film festival hype. The buzz surrounding a movie coming out of a film festival, well, where does it come from? How does it affect the way that you view the film? And really, most times, whether or not it actually is worth the buzz that it's getting. So since Danny was the one who came up with this idea for the day, let's start off with him. Danny, why don't you give us a rundown of your feelings on film festival hype?
Well, I guess that one of the things that is interesting about Sundance is that it's right at the beginning of the year. So when something like Beasts of the Southern Wild plays there, you really have no idea kind of what to expect. And even though in the later festivals, kind of in the fall, when things play there for the first time, it's like you still have a year up, or like a year of build up and kind of waiting to see how they'll be received. And so I think one of the things that is interesting that separates Sundance from kind of the rest of the festivals is that, to me, Sundance kind of has this like aura of like low budget kind of grassroots indie movies, whereas if you go to like Toronto or New York Film Festival, you could find, you know, dozens of movies by big name directors and stars and such. And how that kind of pertains to Beasts of the Southern Wild is interesting, because when that movie became a Sundance hit, and when I finally saw it, because I didn't read a lot about it at first because I didn't want to, when I finally saw it, it was completely different than what I would usually think of a Sundance movie to be, which is kind of more along the lines of what The Surrogate looks like, which is kind of a like romantic dramedy, kind of like cute movie, good dialogue. And Beasts of the Southern Wild is kind of this like visually epic thing, which is not what I usually think about when I think of Sundance.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, that's one of the instances wherein festival buzz can actually work to, I think, enhance a movie. Because I was on your same level. Like, I heard Sundance associated with Beasts of the Southern Wild. Not having read anything about it because I didn't want to spoil myself on it, I was a little bit shocked that this is the movie that everyone was talking about at Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, what about yourself? What are your thoughts on this?
I don't think you can overhype something unless you say a movie's going to cure rickets or something. But
that's your disease of choice.
It's awful, rickets. But the talk surrounding festivals is a very dangerous game, I believe, because when you're the first person to see a movie, I think there is sort of that golden glow that surrounds it, no matter how, for good or for bad, actually. I think that if something is really terrible, you can just sort of say completely how you feel, and if you are a responsible critic, there will be no influence from outside reactions. But if you love something at the same time, there is always the risk that maybe your assessment of it will have kind of a, I don't want to say a bias because it sounds like I'm untrusting of every critic, but I do think that when you're reviewing a movie that you're like one of the first people to see, there's always the chance that you'll give it a more, a fresher shake. Does that make any sense?
I think so.
Yeah, I kind of.
Though I've never heard the term fresher shake before.
Well, I like it. But the idea that I'm trying to insinuate here is that when you're coming out of a film festival where you're seeing these movies that you had never heard of 2 weeks before, you have to. It's hard to divorce yourself from the outside world when you're reviewing a movie. But I think that when you do that, sometimes there is the risk that you'll bring too much to a film and that it's going to sound, your review is going to sound too effusive and or too negative, and you're not at a grounded level.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was going to bring to this discussion. The fact that a lot of times with reviews coming out of festivals, it seems like you either have to fully unqualifiably love something or think it's the worst piece of dreck ever put on earth. This comes through a lot in Cannes when they're talking about whether or not a movie got a standing ovation or was booed at. Like, that's the only reactions you ever really hear about. Not like, you know, the smattering of applause and everyone walks out and kind of promptly forgets about it.
Like when one person booed The Tree of Life and then there was entire yeah. stories about, oh, it's a disaster.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking about. Like, you know, or that was the thing they latched onto.
Or if the Paperboy gets a standing ovation at its premiere, suddenly people are going, the critics were wrong.
Yeah, and
well, not a lot of people, but so.
Yeah, and that like folds into the thing that Danny had said, which is, you know, you come to these festivals and you have an idea of what they're going to be. There's the joke about the Sundance movie. Yeah, it's like it's usually about like some quirky kid and like finding himself and coming of age and low budget and not really good acting. And, you know, when you hear a movie did well at Sundance, usually that's the type of thing that pops into your mind. So for me, I can understand the point of festivals as far as getting new stuff out there. But we have come to a point, I think, just in media saturation and having seen things that come out of these festivals that, you know, opinions have become polarized coming out of them. So you're either going to get, you know, overcorrection in either direction, you know, either positive or negative, but you also have this like stone set idea of what a film probably is. And it seems like there's like a race to get your pull quote from the festival on the theatrical poster for a film. And that is like amazing to me because you can almost see the desperation in the pull quotes that they put on these things. It's like, you know, a majestic, precocious film, like, exclamation point, 5 stars. And it's like, you know, the person might not have liked it that much, but they're like, you know what? I'm going to get my name on a poster. Because you're not going to get that with big Hollywood tentpole films. Because, you know, they don't have time to put all the reviews that were put out the week before onto a poster for it. But with the film festivals, they totally can. And they seem to latch on to that. And the festivals themselves become a way of marketing, I should say, because, you know, if you pick up a DVD of one of these films, one of the first things you'll see on it is the little, are those laurel leaves, the wreaths that say like,
oh, yes.
Official selection, which means nothing. That only means that it's screened there. Like, you know, sometimes it'll something, you know, that's actually important, like Cannes Palme d'Or, but usually it's just like official selection, you know, Schenectady, New York Film Festival.
It's not a good festival.
Probably not. Not to, you know, besmirch the name of Schenectady. I just can't imagine. It's a good film festival.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. So it's weird because, you know, as much as I'd like to go to film festivals because there is that air of, you know, discovery and newness and no one has seen these things before, it's almost like I don't want to buy into the circus, if that makes sense. Like, when I was first becoming... Okay. A film buff or a film enthusiast, you know, film festivals became my way of kind of discerning what film was probably worth my time. And very slowly, I've started to wean myself off of that idea because I've realized that a lot of stuff that comes out of these things are not nearly as good as they're made up to be. I don't know if I'd call it overhyping, but I think it definitely is just this concept of having to, you know, become a little more cynical about it. Like Nick was saying, you know, you're giving it too much of a fresh shake.
Right. And I mean, I know many critics who go to festivals. We've actually published reviews at festivals that have been quoted on DVD covers and in trailers. So maybe we should just back up for one second and say, not every critic who gets a quote is a hack.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's not what I'm saying.
I know. I'm just saying that you... Maybe we should be careful when chastising those who get a quote from a festival review, because there's that old saying that I can't think of right now. People in glass houses, is that it?
That might be it. Yeah, no, maybe. And like I'm not saying that, you know, that's the only reason they do it, but...
No.
Yeah.
I know, but...
Okay, good.
Just...
Though I'd have to say that my favorite kind of festival poster, this is kind of off topic, but I just love it when you walk into an independent theater and they just have a blow up of the entire review.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that? Like just the page from Variety.
Mm-hmm.
Who stops and reads that?
It's usually on a big like cardboard stand too. I
find. Exactly. Yeah. It's on an easel hanging out right in the lobby.
Yeah. I suppose if you're waiting for your movie to start.
But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things. I mean, do either of you view any festival in particular, or just do you view hype coming out of festivals? What kind of, do you take it with a grain of salt? Or do you allow yourself to become elevated in your expectations because of it?
I think I do both, which is obviously contradictory, but...
I was about to say that. That's awful.
I know. It's not good, but let me think. Like this year at Cannes, I was not paying much attention to Holy Motors, but then when a lot of critics I respect are giving it effusive praise and they're saying it's one of the best movies of the year, bar none, you're going to start paying attention. Right. But at the same time, I kind of slow down with reading the reviews after a bit, because it's not just a matter of wanting to go in fresh, but it's also an issue of, okay, I've barely seen anything from this movie. And before the festival, I barely knew anything about it. So how much anticipation do I really want to have going in? I kind of like the idea that with a movie such as this, such as that one, you can just sort of enter the theater with a relatively fresh outlook and then walk away feeling, not that you're not confident in your opinion in the first place, but in this case, you know that you're just kind of assessing it as it is.
All right, Danny, what about yourself?
Well, just in terms of Cannes, I think there specifically, if you're reading kind of like overviews of how a movie was received, I think like the phrase mixed reviews at Cannes can be very skewed. Because a lot of times what mixed reviews at Cannes means is that most people liked it, but no one thought it was like a masterpiece. I'm kind of thinking like one of the, there are a couple of films I could name from this
like
year.
Lawless.
Like Lawless.
I was about to say
or
Lawless.
Maybe Mud,
yeah.
Or maybe like Killing Them Softly, which is like, there's still new movies by good directors that are good movies, but because people don't think it's like going to win the Palme d'Or, it kind of gets this like reputation as being kind of a mixed reviewed movie, but then it usually comes out in theaters and gets acclaimed. So it's kind of interesting.
Cannes reception is a dodgy thing to begin with, because this is the same festival that gave quote unquote mixed reviews to Inglourious Basterds and The Tree of Life, for example. And then those ended up being my favorite movies of their respective year. So,
well, do you think that's
you know, I mean, but then again, I mean, Tree of Life, the initial reaction was mixed, even though it won the Palme d'Or. And then I remember I saw it that same day, and I walked out, and first I was, you know, I just had a religious experience. But then after that, I kind of thought to myself, what the fuck were people talking about with their mixed reviews?
Freak.
I know. How could they have an opinion different from mine?
I know. That's ridiculous, right? It's awful. I can't. People not agreeing with me. I don't know, man. This world. I feel like we've exhausted this topic pretty thoroughly. And actually, we can use this topic as a lead-in to our feature review, which again is Beast of the Southern Wild, directed by Ben Zeitlin and starring Kuvenzane Wallace.
The whole universe depends on everything fitting together just right. Have one piece bust, even the smallest piece, the entire universe would get busted.
This here is an aurochs, a fierce creature.
The star's coming!
Y'all better learn how to survive.
I'm your daddy. It is my job to take care of you.
Okay?
Okay, so Beast of the Southern Wild is question mark? I feel like this is a film that might be hard to sum up in a succinct way. It follows a young girl and her father in a small community town, right on the edge of the Gulf Coast, it seems. And they're kind of steeling themselves for a massive environmental disaster that will bury them under a deluge. And yeah, I mean, that kind of sums it up. There's a lot more, obviously, but that's just a good way to break into it. I wanted to ask, you know, before we really even get into the specifics of the plot, what was your opinion on this film? But not only that, but what had you heard about it before? And did your opinion on the film sync up with that? Or do you think that you fell outside of line with what you'd heard? So, Nick, why don't you start us off?
Meh.
Okay, was that your opinion or was that the opinion that you'd heard? Can
that was my opinion. From meh? Okay. The opinion that I had heard is, dare I say, mixed.
Oh,
no, I won't say that. The opinion that I have heard is mostly positive. I have been getting word about this film for almost 6 months now when it first premiered at Sundance, and I went, Beast of the Southern Wild, what kind of title is that? And then over the ensuing months, you get the trailer and you get the poster and the 8,000 fucking images of that kid running with the fireworks.
Sparkers.
And yes. Oh my God. Just bring another image.
I'm not a fan of that poster. I will say that.
And just, it's not. Okay. Anyway. But yes, as the film has, this is what we talked about just a few minutes ago. As the film came closer to its release, he started getting other reviews, which said, well, this movie isn't very good. It's kind of a phony, facile version of an independent film. It's sort of handcrafted from a distant point of view. And that's what I would say with the movie. I don't think it's a bad film. It'd be silly to... Well, actually, is it a bad film? I don't know. Maybe. But, well, rather, I should say it's not a terrible film.
Okay. It's not a fiasco.
No, it's okay. But there's a difference between being something and acting a certain way. Werner Herzog movies are crazy because Werner Herzog is crazy. But Neville Dean and Taylor movies are garbage because they're acting like they're crazy. You see?
Yes, I get your point in that way.
Terrence Malick films have an ethereal, almost surreal feeling to them because Terrence Malick is a mad genius. But this movie has an ethereal, almost surreal film to it because Ben Zeitlin likes Terrence Malick films. Do you see what I'm saying?
Is this something that he could, in your opinion, looking at this film, do you believe that he was approaching it purely from a stylistic standpoint? Or do you think this is something he wants to be able to achieve that he could get better at as time goes on?
Both. I think he is approaching this from a stylistic standpoint, but in the sense that he's trying to emulate a certain style. He's not bringing it to the table. Do you see what I mean? Instead of bringing it to the table, he's constructing it at the table.
Okay. Yes. Well,
and we'll get to that more in a few minutes. But in the meantime, I just didn't find the primary story to be that compelling. The young girl is kind of annoying, I thought. She just sort of stares the entire movie. Just does a lot of staring. Just kind of looks off in the distance. And the movie has a terrible moral center to it, which nobody has discussed, which really bothers me.
Well, I guess, is this something we can get into now, or do you think we should say that's for spoilers?
We can save that. No, this should be saved for spoilers. Okay. But
I wasn't sure if you could summarize it without ruining it.
There is a shot in this film. There's a shot in this film that when it occurred, I thought, okay, let's hold on for 1 second. Is this movie really promoting what I think it's promoting? There's one word that I can use for it, but it would be a spoiler.
Okay. So, if you haven't been hooked by this podcast yet, you now have a reason to stick around.
Yes.
But before we jump into that, Danny, why don't you let us know what you'd heard about the film, what you thought of it, and how your opinion lined up?
Well, in terms of what I had heard about it from Sundance, I'd heard that people really liked it. And I guess you could say I did a poor job of kind of figuring out what it was because I didn't really read anything beyond, like, you know, one of the better movies to play at Sundance this year. And then I had a chance to see it for free. They had a screening at New York University in about April or May because some of the producers and below the line workers are alumni there. And so when I went in to see it, I literally had like no sense of what the plot was or like who was in it. You know, I figured it was like nobody I would know. And so when like the first shots started popping up and it was like this decrepit landscape, I was just really kind of taken aback at first because I had no idea that's what was coming. But I was eventually won over to a large extent by just how emotional it is between the father and daughter. And I think one of the things that's interesting is Nick brought up Terrence Malick. And I've been comparing this film a lot to Days of Heaven, just in terms of how I'm thinking about it, because they're very much constructed kind of within this child's point of view. One of the things that I think separates it is that Days of Heaven kind of, through the daughter's point of view, kind of gives off this muted emotional design. And that's, I mean, that's clearly by design. That's not a complaint, but that's just kind of a fact of the movie. And Beasts is kind of the opposite, where instead of the child seeing things in a muted way, she sees them in a very amplified, kind of over the top way. And I think that's something that, you know, like these new reviews that have been piling in have shown, is that it can be very divisive because it is so like aggressive and over the top. But I thought it was very moving and beautiful.
Yeah. I think I definitely fall more in line with your opinion than Nick's, though I'm eager to hear what Nick had to say in terms of his one word, you know, summation of the movie's moral center. That I'm wondering if it's going to rock my very opinion to its foundations.
It's not the movie's very moral center, but we'll get to it.
I'm excited about that. I kind of just want to skip right ahead, but no, I thought the movie was really good, and I actually, aside from hearing, you know, the good reception that it got, and a lot of people saying it was great, and I don't even know where I heard it from, but someone mentioned the Malick comparison. I think George Washington was another one that it got compared to a little, and that was about it. I stayed away from everything else, because I do like to go in to a movie like this that's well received, that I know will probably come to me, with as little information as possible, which was probably a really good idea for this, because this movie kind of came out of nowhere for me. I didn't really have an expectation, but if I did, this movie probably would have defied it anyway. I understand what you're saying, Nick, about this kind of very not as deeply felt stylistic construction, and I get that, but I still think that the movie pulls it off well enough to, I don't want to say overcome, but I think that the movie is well shot, and I think that the world it creates is interesting, and it was a place that I enjoyed being and visiting and having to kind of parse out the clues as to what the hell was going on. And I thought that young Miss Wallace did a really good job with her character, and like Danny said, the interactions between her and her father, which comprise, you know, the primary relationship in the film, were really, really good. And every scene they were in was some kind of weird hypnotic. I wanted to see more of them. There are some odd fantastical elements that I'm surprised don't get talked about more, because I feel like if there's a place the movie really could fall off the rails, that would be it. And for the longest time in the movie, I was thrown off by them. I don't know if they're technically a spoiler, because, I mean, even on the IMDb page, that they're mentioned in the synopsis. But I won't say what it is right now, just out of deference to the film. But, yeah, I think the film pulled it off pretty well at the end. I'm still vaguely, I guess, like, flabbergasted that happened. It's one of those things, I kind of compare it to Magnolia, because that was a movie that I thought was really great, and then it has an ending that relies upon an odd meteorological event.
You can say it.
Can I just... Yeah, okay. So Magnolia ends with a rain
of frogs. I feel
like
if you haven't seen it and you're listening to this podcast, there's something very wrong here.
Maybe it's not like the best idea to like let you be the devil and angel on my shoulders. Like, yeah, just spoil the movie, Brian. They don't deserve to happen to anything. But yeah, no, that movie ends with a rain of frogs, which comes out of kind of nowhere. There are hints moving up towards it, but it's not the type of thing where if you're watching the movie, you're like, well, some crazy biblical thing is going to happen at the end. And this movie has a similar event. But like I said, as my intrepidation towards it melted away once it actually came to its final point. So I think the movie won me over in that respect. I would say that this is probably not one of my favorite of the year, but it is pretty high up there. You know, depending upon how many other really good films come out this year. And honestly, I can't think of many that are something I'm looking forward to. This still could probably end up in my top 10.
Okay.
Okay. So that's our basic assessment of the film.
I have to say, I can acknowledge that, because, you know, this is opinion, that my reaction to it is very much a gut feeling, and it's not. That's how much of my reaction to this film has been. It's me just looking at it and going, no, no, you can't do that. That's wrong. No. Whereas you guys are looking at the movie and you're going along with it, which there's really nothing that can be done about.
Well, do you feel that it doesn't, you obviously seem to feel that it doesn't earn some of the things that it does, correct?
Yeah.
Is this another thing that we have to wait for spoilers to dive into?
No, not necessarily.
Okay, so why don't you explain to us a little bit, like, what you think it doesn't earn?
I think the emotional payoff is misguided, because the father in this movie is a fucking psychopath. I mean, Jesus, he is not a good father at all. He's horrible. Does nobody talk about this?
Well, here's the thing. Did you, when, because I'm still even a little bit, the world in this movie, like I said, is very odd, and I'm not sure how much of it is supposed to resemble something that could conceivably happen from our world. It's not like a speculative, future, forward-looking fiction. Like, to me, it's almost like a fantastical sort of fairy tale, and in that way, I can allow myself to absorb these heightened emotions, and the father's, his explosive rage, and just the way that he responds to things is crazy. Like, you can't say it any other way. The guy really does seem to be a little bit off his rocker, and I was able to accept that because the world that they had created in this movie was the type of place that would drive someone to that level of madness, and it makes sense that in trying to pass on kind of survival tips or, you know, guidelines for living in this world, he would take up the posture of an almost animalistic, you know, alpha male figure.
See, no, but that's part of the incongruity between the world and the story. The movie is trying so hard to be gritty and to be down to earth, but then you throw in these fantastical elements, which, okay, you can do that, but you need to handle it better. And the father is a big part of this problem, because he's not, we're going to go back to him, so strap in. In The Tree of Life, Brad Pitt's character is about as bad as the father in this film. I would actually prefer to have him as a dad, though, because
Brad Pitt,
he doesn't make me go fishing. And
not a fan of fishing?
It's very boring. He just makes me hit him.
He makes you hit him, and he makes you close the screen door 40 times.
Yes. But the thing is, that movie does not purport to have mythical beasts. It doesn't have the...
What do you call dinosaurs, Nick?
They're not mythical, they're real. Unless you're one of those people.
I was making a joke.
In which case, this podcast will end. But no.
Jesus.
You have to compare it to that, because I think that's the finest reference point. There is no reason for him to act this way and to still be played off as some noble character who's trying to take care of his daughter, because I never really got that impression. He goes away for days, and turns out he's at the hospital, and when asking, what happened to you? Because that's a natural concern. If your father goes missing and he comes back and he's wearing a hospital gown, you'd be terrified, and he's just saying, go away, child, or something like that. And what?
Go away, child. I don't know. No, it was good. We'll keep it in. I just wasn't sure if I was allowed to laugh at that.
What?
Because that was a terrible Louisiana accent. Anyway, go ahead.
I can just add more. And then at the end, you have this supposedly emotional scene where she's caring for him and he's about to die. And I got what Zeitlin was going for. It's very clear, but it doesn't feel earned in the slightest. I didn't care about this father, and I can't say the word yet, but it ties directly into my biggest problem with the movie, which we'll get into in spoilers.
Even though you've already just told us that the father's dying.
Yes. Oh, come on.
That's pretty early.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was about to say it happens early. Danny, what are your thoughts on this? Like this issue that Nick
well,
and
just,
are hashing out.
Just to quickly address the idea of him, like being this animal, but still this noble figure. It was like to me, the movie was so kind of compressed within Hush Puppy's worldview that like that's how everyone kind of sees their father. That kind of like no matter what they do, you're still gonna like idealize them and look up to them. And so then when the payoff comes at the end, that's why it worked for me. So yeah, that's what I would say.
Okay, because I was gonna say, I mean, to me, this movie and the characters in it, aside from Hush Puppy, obviously, are like a massive overcorrection in the direction of, you know, bestial living. You know, like, these are people who are allowing their more primal natures to come out. I mean, like, they have parties all the time. They're just constantly wasted. And it seems like they're using that as a kind of buffer against this very cruel, uncaring reality they're going to have to deal with. And, you know,
so they're bums?
They're bums?
Is that's what you're saying?
Is that... I don't know. I don't even know how to respond to that. I mean, I wouldn't think of it as being a bum. I would think of it as going a little hedonistic. I mean, I don't know if bums are hedonists, but, you know, it's possible. And yeah, I agree with Danny that there's that concept of, you know, looking at your father and he's this completely unknowable figure and you idealize him even in his worst moments. But yeah, I think that's a good point in which we can go into spoilers, because I am looking forward to hearing what Nick has to say about this movie. So if you haven't seen it, I would definitely say that if it's around you, you should check it out. It's only like an hour and a half long, so it's not a big investment of time. And I think that if you happen to, your tastes happen to co-align with mine, you will probably get a lot out of it. Danny, you would also say that people should go see it?
Yeah, definitely.
And Nick, are you saying that you said it wasn't a terrible movie?
No.
That was your qualified judgment on it.
It's just not good.
Okay, so you would say don't go see it.
If it's on HBO in, what would that be, like February or so?
All right. Going into spoilers now, though. Nick, why don't you get into that thing that you've been talking about that I can't wait to hear.
Terrorist. That is what the father in this movie is. He's a terrorist. And that bothered the hell out of me. What is with the scene where they blow up a fucking levee? What is going on? Why are the... What... Anybody? Can anybody defend that scene to me? Or the actions? Or the way the movie treats it? Or the way it affects the plot later on and how it ties into the emotional resolve? Can anybody make it not seem like a horrible, horrible decision?
But I think it's supposed to be a horrible, horrible decision.
No, I'm talking about a horrible decision on the filmmaker's...
Oh, to include it in the movie. yeah, I mean, that scene is... I don't know.
They blow up a levee.
They do blow up a levee. Jeez. And the consequences of that... yeah, I know what you're saying. This is going to be one of those things where I'm not really good at defending a movie. I saw that, and yes, that was like a terrorist action. And it was an extremely narcissistic, selfish, self-serving thing of him to do. And it was purely predicated on like sticking it to the man and trying to maintain his foothold in this community that they'd created. Because like there's a point where you realize these people could very well just go somewhere else and probably be okay. But there's this concept of like strength is sticking to where you are, and strength is obstinance and stubbornness and not moving. And I feel like that's the absolute nadir of their desire to do that, is acting in that way and doing this ridiculous, awful thing that in the end doesn't really matter much anyway, because the waters have risen and already killed their land. Like, the salt is everywhere and the animals are dead and the trees are dead. So it's a pointless gesture on his part.
But the movie treats it like it's some noble act.
I didn't get that feeling. Danny, did you?
Yeah, see, I think that's another area where we differ, because one of the reasons I liked scenes like this in the movie is because I think it is like very critical of these people in some respects. So I know some people have said like this movie to them was nothing, like it was just like a group of hippies thinking that they're better, you know, than everyone else, or that their lifestyle is more rich. But, like, I think there are these moments like that one where it is, like, you know, while there are scenes where they're drinking and everyone's having fun and, like, it's all a great time, there are scenes where, like, they're very kind of flawed, messed up people. And I think that just adds another angle into the narrative that's kind of necessary. Because if you don't have that scene or a couple others, then they are just kind of, like, drinking hippies who don't want to work or whatnot.
But when does the movie show them as anything other than drinking hippies who don't want to work?
Well, I mean, I think if you tie in like the like magical realist elements, like with these beasts, I think it is kind of drawing this comparison that's inherently negative of like calling these people beasts. So I think that's kind of like an overriding thing that I took.
Okay.
Which, you know, I don't know if that's far-fetched or not, but like...
I thought the beasts were some heavy-handed bullshit metaphor about the girl overcoming her personal struggles or whatnot. I just read that differently, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's just like... And it is that, obviously, but like, when I think of the title, it's like I don't really know if I'm supposed to be thinking of the animals or the people, and I think that's kind of like something in the movie that's interesting.
See, I don't think the film ever portrays them as beasts. I think they're always supposed to be these simple, lovable country folk who are living the dream, if you will.
But what about, like, when he's in the hospital and, like, the doctor's like, you're sick, and, like, they just start punching everyone?
This is another part of my problem. I think the movie's facile nature is completely exposed when they go into the real world. Because then I'm just seeing these people as these more or less savages who don't live in civilized society and refuse to play by its rules. And, you know, a big problem with the movie is that it kind of sticks around with them after that. After that scene, you never get the idea that these people shouldn't be living here and that they're irresponsible and whatnot. I mean, when the helicopter comes and it's telling them to leave, the implication I got from the formal qualities of the film was that this is a sad thing that's happening. In my head, I can only think, you brought this upon yourselves, you idiots. You attracted attention when you blew up a levee with dynamite. And when they're in the hospital and they're attacking the doctors, I'm thinking to myself, they're just trying to help them. They're only doing their job. And why am I going to side with them over trained medical professionals or actors playing trained medical professionals?
No, they were real medical professionals, so yeah. Certainly.
That's how they got such a lively performance out of them. No, I think you're supposed to think that, because I definitely did, because you go through this movie and like the first opening scenes with the just as an aside, I loved the music in this film.
Yeah.
Can we agree on that, Nick? They're not a fan.
It was fine. Okay. I mean, it's not my kind of music, but it's all okay. Right.
Well, yeah, there's the opening scene. She's kind of explaining their community, and there's a massive feast, and everyone's drinking, and there's parties and explosions, and it's great. And you're supposed to get this feeling of like, yeah, that's an interesting way to live, and it's free of the burdens of, you know, fucking whatever. Just all that kind of hippie nonsense, if we're going to go using that word, which we've been using pretty freely. But the more that you see of these people, the more you see the emptiness and the artifice behind that. And I think that it's almost jarring when they finally get taken to the real world, because you have this kind of idea in your head that all of society has collapsed because this is the only community you're seeing. And then you get taken to the real world. Well, there are still buses and there's still hospitals and there's still, you know, normal medicine, because the medicine in this community is like twigs and bark and dirt thrown into a jug.
Very effective. Like,
yeah. Mm. And, it would be easy for the movie to kind of like take the noble savage route and say like this is a better way of living, but I don't think it does do that. And I think that almost entirely the point of it is that these people, in their desire to not be moved and in their desire to remain stronger than the forces trying to act on them, have lost their way. And I think that that's kind of the point of Hush Puppy. Is she is this societal, nurturing, maternal force coming back and leading them out of this decrepit situation that they've gotten into. And I think you're supposed to see the things that they do as either reprehensible or just unfathomable, so that when she finally does, you know, pick them all up and begin to march them off into some new tomorrow, that it becomes something that's triumphant, because you can see that the errors of their ways are maybe going to be corrected, at least.
Just kind of thought they were going back to their old ways, and now they can, now that they've had this scuffle with the outside world, they can go back to drinking and shooting off fireworks.
I mean, obviously you can still do that on the weekends, but as we all do, I think. But no, see, for me, she goes, there's a point in this film where they, the children, the girls, swim out to a boat, which then takes them to, can we just call this place a brothel? I mean, I'm pretty sure that's kind of what it is. Where they, for the first time in the entire movie, receive a loving, nurturing interaction from someone, like, you know, a mother figure. They dance with these waitresses slash whores, I'm assuming, and Hush Puppy goes and talks to a woman who cooks alligator the way that her father used to describe her mother making it, and she sees here people who are thriving because of a community of love and understanding and all this other stuff, rather than just, you know, covering up all of their woes with this implausible ideal of strength, like nothing is going to affect me because I'm strong, which only leads to this, you know, moldering sense of loss on the inside that eventually bursts out. I mean, the entire movie her father tells her that she can't cry, and then finally at the end, you know, when she brings him this alligator, he's crying and she's crying, and they have a moment where they realize that, you know, strength is one thing, but just being able to interface with another human being is the only true way to affect them in that way. Am I talking out of my ass? Am I making a cogent point?
Yeah.
Okay. Because, I mean, if you think about it, there's a scene where this guy is trying to teach her how to eat a crab. And if you've ever eaten crabs, you know you're supposed to, you know, press it in, pop the lock, and rip it open. And there is, like, a weird kind of ritual to it. And her father sees this and becomes, like, infuriated that this man is trying to, like, civilize the way that they're eating. And so he, you know, screams at her to just beast it, and he just takes up a crab, rips it in half, and just, like, sucks the innards out of it, and he makes her do it as well, and she does it, and this is an action that's enforced. This is an escape from a very basic level of humanity and civilization that they're enforcing in her, and it takes a long time to get her away from that, to, again, the point where there's a 7-year-old girl leaving a community of people out of this kind of terrifying wasteland that they've made for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of ties back into my idea that the father is not a good guy or a noble character. During that scene, I was thinking, man, this is not a, it's not a good guy.
I think that the best way to look at the father, and this is the way that I looked at him, is he is a very misguided person. I mean,
that's one way of putting it, yeah.
I mean, we're... This is odd. We're led to assume that the mother died in childbirth, correct?
Yeah. She, like, tells the story about, like, she swam away or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she says that she can count the number of times that she's been held on two fingers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a heartbreaking line. And that, again, really reinforces this idea of strength valued over nurturing or understanding. And I think the father, you know, between losing the woman he loved because of the baby they had and... just, you know, not having any kind of community to help him raise this woman. I mean, he makes her live in a separate house. He calls her to dinner with a bell on a clothesline. Like, he's not a good father, but he's not an evil man, if that makes sense.
He's a bad man. That goes first as he's a bad guy.
Danny, do you have an opinion on the moral...
I love him.
You love him?
Want him to be my dad. No, I didn't mean the last part. I mean, I just think he's, like, part of his environment. I don't, like, it's like if you're a doctor in a hospital and he's, like, punching you and screaming at you, like, it would be easier for me to hate him. But, like, as just a viewer of the movie, I really cared for him.
Yeah, and I took that journey because at first I thought he was an asshole. Like, did not like this guy. But the more I saw and the more we got to know him and this world that he's been living in, I mean, the more it made sense to me that this is who he is and that this is what he believes is the best way to raise a child, especially in this world that they've made for themselves. And I think, you know, it's one of these things. I feel like we've all made decently good points about, you know, trying to get our viewpoint across. I think it is just a fundamental difference in how we view it. Because I'm not hearing us really defending his actions. I think we can all say that they're vaguely reprehensible. It's just whether or not you think the movie is lauding that or, you know, saying that it's bad and how much you're willing to forgive this guy. Because we don't have a fundamental objective difference on what he does and how it is. I guess just, we talked a little bit about the titular beasts. I think that that ties into the community and the people. Though there are some giant pig monsters. Aurochs is what they're called, I believe.
Yeah.
And I know Dan, or I know Nick, you said that you thought that was a bullshit metaphor.
Yeah, it
overcoming
just...
stuff.
Well, partially because it has no real tie-in to the rest of the movie. It feels very extraneous. It's sort of like a Beast of the Southern Wild in a china shop.
Sequel.
Oh,
it's a special feature on the Blu-ray. A beast in a china shop.
That would actually be awesome. No, I mean, it's funny because, you know, when they first show up and you see them running... just smashing through everything on their way to meet this community. Because there's an almost, you know, it's a tragic inevitability that something is going to happen with these creatures. And, yeah, I thought that it was going to be a bullshit metaphor. And, you know, honestly, on some level, it is a bullshit metaphor. But for some reason, I was able to get behind it. I can't even begin to defend why I was able to get behind that. Because they show up. And I know exactly what's going to happen. Like, she's going to turn around, she's going to do something or say something, and they're going to, like, bow to her or, you know, become subdued by her through the sheer majesty of her small, innocent wonder. And it happens. But I think because of her acting and because of the very critical way that the movie views everything else, I think that it works. And I don't know if it was necessary. It pretty much is extraneous. It's not vitally important to the film itself, but there's something about it, an almost ethereal, unnameable quality that I think does elevate the movie a bit for me. And I know that's a cop-out to say I like it and I can't say why, but that's unfortunately the truth.
Nah, it's fine.
Thank you. Danny, what did
if it feels right, it works.
If it feels right, it works. Danny, what did you think about that? The beasts.
I mean, I think like you, like the final moment made it for me, particularly when they show the dad like on his deathbed, kind of watching her approach the Auroch. It's just like just devastating to me. But I think, I mean, it would be easy to make the argument that they are like a forced metaphor. But you know, I was just very moved by it.
And, what about it did you find moving? I'm curious.
I found, well, like I said, like the shot of the dad, like finally seeing like his daughter kind of like make a stand right before he's about to die. It's like just a perfect moment.
Yeah, I felt that.
And like by that moment, I was so just like floored by how emotional the father-daughter thing was to me. That, I mean, like they basically, like, you know, when she's feeding him the alligator or like they're basically not saying anything. But by that point, I was just so into it that like they just had to look at each other, and it was like a great scene for me.
I was bothered by the fact that she kept staring.
I might just have to see this again to see about the staring thing.
Don't do it. It's gonna ruin it.
It's gonna ruin it
for you.
It's like the first time I pointed out to my my parents that you could hear Yoko Ono singing in the background of "So This Is Christmas." They can't listen to that song anymore.
Interesting. How do you feel about her solo line in Rocky Raccoon? Oh, no, not Rocky Raccoon. Other White Album song. Bungalow Bill.
Oh, God. I don't like her at all. So I think that could give you a pretty decent idea. Damn you, Yoko Ono.
Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill.
You've got a thing about singing on this podcast. I like that. I'm going to nurture that. We're gonna figure out something for you to sing every episode.
Let's exploit it.
I cannot wait until we talk about Les Miserables, because I'm just gonna make you sing a selection from every song in that movie.
Yeah, I don't really know any songs from Les Miserables.
I know that entire musical inside and out.
I tend to get that and Phantom of the Opera mixed up.
That is, I guess they both involve French people, so that's,
they're on Broadway.
Kind of okay.
Didn't Andrew Lloyd Webber work on both? Maybe.
Nah, Andrew Lloyd Webber did. This is so off topic. Andrew Lloyd Webber did Phantom of the Opera, but he did not do Les Miserables. I unfortunately do not know who did Les Miserables. Okay, so obviously, since we're now talking about...
What were we talking about?
Pieces of Southern Wine. Do we have any closing thoughts on this before we move into our picks for the coming week?
Okay, I've sounded more negative than I really am, because I feel like when I'm talking about the film with two people who really enjoyed it, I sort of have to assert, I have to stand my ground. I have to be like Hush Puppy.
Like Hush Puppy.
Yeah.
I gotta stare down that beast, and that beast is your positive reactions. It's a metaphor for Brian and Danny's positive views on the film. And then I guess The Land They Destroy is, who gives a shit? But yeah, the movie is fine. It's fine. It's just not good.
Okay. I, on the other hand, think that the movie is quite good. I believe I gave it an A- on...
You did?
The film stage. Yeah. I'd stand by that. Usually, like, I hate grading a film with a letter or a number.
Yeah.
Or a star or whatever the hell else. But no, I think that the A minus fits, because that to me says this is a really good film that is really worth seeing. And you know, the minus, obviously, you know, there are issues with it that could have been trimmed. And I don't know, I wanted more of the world. I wanted to understand what was happening more than the movie gave us. And it's not like a knock against the film in terms of writing. I think that they showed as much as they wanted to, and they showed as much as they needed to. But I was just kind of so fascinated with this community and this impending disaster that I just wanted to understand it more.
Wait for the online prequel comic.
Damn you, transmedia promotions. Danny, give us your final, you know, one sentence summation of your feelings on this film.
Really good. Really liked it. Recommend it.
Excellent.
Succinct.
Succinct. Brevity is the soul of wit. Well, so now you have our opinions on that. You can check that out. It's in limited release. And now we're going to talk about what's coming up for the next week that you should check out. Coming to DVD Tuesday, July 17th, we have The Three Stooges, Lockout, starring Guy Pearce and Maggie Grace, Salmon Fishing in the Yemen, Friends with Kids, Get the Gringo, Intruders, 444. You do not sound particularly enthused about any of these, Nick.
I want to see 444, actually.
All right.
Abel Ferrara.
Yeah, I
kind of want
to see that.
Yeah.
I've heard some mixed things, but Abel Ferrara movies always get mixed reviews, but people who like it really like it, so...
You're using that damn word a lot. Oh, I forgot. Casa de mi Padre is also going to be out. The Will Ferrell faux... telenovela thing.
Oh, everything.
Yeah. I will say that I really enjoyed Lockout.
Did you know?
I did. I liked Lockout a lot. I can't defend that opinion. It's not like it's a movie that's going to change your life. And it's not like
and
deeply
I was
invested.
Expecting it.
Yeah, yeah, I thought well, so. Maybe
with a premise like maximum security space prison, like how could you not think that that was going to change your life? I actually, for another site that I write for, I wrote the list of the 10 reasons it was better than the Avengers. That did not go over well. But
I like that without even having seen Lockout. I'm just a fan of that piece.
Yeah. No, I just thought Lockout was, it's fun. It feels like a 1993 action movie. Like that kind of insane premise, like Die Hard in a space prison. I say check it out. I mean, like, if you can get behind it, you know, if you're a fan of like Con Air and The Rock, you're probably going to like Lockout. Not everything has to be Terrence Malick. I'm just going to throw
that
out there.
No, I like Guy Pearce, and sometimes Luc Besson is fun.
Yeah, I just feel like I have to throw that out there because a lot of people are like, you know, you like Terrence Malick, how can you like Lockout?
I wouldn't want everything to be Terrence Malick. They get a little tiring.
Yeah.
it would make his films less special, wouldn't it?
Precisely. Exactly. And, you know, sometimes you just want to watch, oh, shoot, Storage Wars is coming out on DVD? That is a great show. And I'm not even joking. You should check out Storage Wars. I think it's on A&E. Holy crap. It's an addictive show. But yeah, that's. Does anyone else have any DVD picks that they want to highlight?
I think Danny will be happy to hear the Turn Horses coming out on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I was a big fan of that. I would say that, I mean, I obviously love it, but I'd be intrigued to see how it holds up on a smaller screen because it has this just majestic score, and like every take is like 5 minutes, and it's black and white cinematography, and it's just gorgeous to look at. So I wonder how well it'll hold up.
It's got the leaflets or the leaves on the cover. I do want to see that. I've only seen one other Bellatar film, which maybe I should be ashamed of, but I like that movie, Werkmeister Harmonies.
Yeah, that's the only other I've only seen it too.
That's very good.
I've not seen any of those, and now I feel kind of bad because I just read the description of the Turn Horse, and it sounds...
I mean, it basically, like, I saw it, I wrote a review for the film stage, and I saw it at a screening. I think it was only in theaters for, like, hardly any time.
Well, now that we have our DVD
picks... Oh, selected, wait, I didn't go.
I thought you did. All right, never mind. Nick, what's your what do you want to highlight?
Down by Law is being reissued by Criterion on Blu-ray.
Oh, nice.
And also Mean Streets is coming out on Blu-ray.
Mean Streets.
Ooh. Yeah. What, you don't like Mean Streets?
No, I like it. Those are like a good... Oof.
Oh.
He's horrible, getting verklempt.
Horrible Blu-ray arts. My God.
Really?
Because the DVD that I own just uses the original poster, which is great. It's a beautiful image. It makes it look like Brooklyn's Finest or something.
Is it the one with like the gun outline with the city?
There is. It's been turned to its side, and
yeah.
There's a. Are you looking at it right now?
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh dear.
Damn.
It looks exactly like the Brooklyn's Finest cover.
It does. Yeah.
And it's got a shot of Robert De Niro holding a gun, looking crazy, like this is Taxi Driver.
I wonder why they want to. Like, put themselves up against Brooklyn's Finest. Like, that's a tough fight to win.
Oh, my God.
But the movie's good, and hopefully the transfer will be good, too. I think Scorsese is kind of particular about the Blu-ray transfers of his movies, as he should be, so...
I was about to say, as the man spearheading, you know, archiving and all that other stuff, I feel like he'd probably do a pretty good transfer.
Yeah, I had no idea it was coming out until I was looking at a little website here, so...
Well, that is awesome. So yeah, now that we actually have gotten through all of our DVD picks.
I'm sorry
that I forgot about you, because now I feel like you think that I was me trying to get you back for not liking Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is not the case.
Now that we're done, let's move on.
Yes.
We can finally go to the next segment.
Yes. Theatrical review or theatrical reviews. God damn it. new theatrical releases coming out this Friday, July 20th. Not much of anything.
Blank slate.
Queen of Versailles, a documentary that follows a billionaire couple as they begin construction of a mansion inspired by Versailles. Shut Up and Play the Hits. Something about LCD Sound System playing its final show at Madison Square Garden. What was that?
It's playing for one day, July 18th.
Shut Up and Play the Hits?
Yep, that's it.
Damn.
It's playing near me, too. I might go see it.
Yeah, you ought to. And report back to us.
I might be seeing something else that day.
War of the Buttons comes out. No idea what that is. An Occupied France. Play war between two rival kid gangs.
Mm.
The Well Digger's Daughter. I almost refuse to watch anything that... has a title that is an occupation and then a relation to the occupation. So like The Astronaut's Wife, The Time Traveler's Wife, The Arsonist's Daughter. I mean, things like that, I just can't get behind that.
It's funny.
It's a rule that I've established for myself, and it served me pretty well. But yeah, that's about it. Nothing at all really coming out. It's July 20th, kind of a dead day.
Yeah, I'll probably have to see something again, or I don't know.
Yeah, choose your battles wisely, people, because it's barren out there.
We can review Salmon Fishing in the Yemen.
We could.
Just out on Blu-ray.
You know, Emily Blunt, Ewan McGregor, pretty awesome.
Yep.
Maybe have some salmon while watching it.
I hate fish. I don't know if I'll be able to partake.
You hate fish?
I don't like fish.
It's like my favorite food.
I don't know. I can't get behind it. It's the texture and the taste and everything else about it.
Divine.
First of all, we're using the term fish. Like, there's a lot of different kind of fish. I like golden tile and flounder, but I do not like literally every other fish in the sea. I will do an ahi tuna steak if it's lightly blackened. Anyway, this is unimportant. We're talking about movies here. So what about... What are our random recommendations? Things that we've seen recently, not new to DVD or coming to theaters, but movies that we think you should check out. So, Nick, why don't you start us off? What is your random recommendation?
My random recommendation, I'm going to go with Roman Polanski's. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, God.
God damn it. Ninth game.
I'm going to go with Amarcord, the Federico Fellini movie from 1973, which... I had never seen before. I don't know how that happened. It passed because I tend to kind of love, I tend to love Fellini, so it just kind of slipped by. But finally watched it. Beautiful movie. Very, very well composed. Entertaining. Like it's nobody's business. And amazingly personal, too, as his best work is. So check it out. It's, you know, Fellini, he's pretty good.
That's on Criterion, so it should be on Hulu, correct?
That's where I watched it.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, it looks pretty good, too.
Danny, what about yourself?
I watched a movie called Somersault from 2004. It was on Netflix Instant, and the only thing I'd seen of it before was the poster of Abbie Cornish. So when Sam Worthington's name showed up in the credits, I was a little bit surprised because I had no idea he was in this, but apparently it was kind of like one of his breakout roles. They're both really good. It's kind of like she's a teenager. She kisses her mom's boyfriend, and the mom catches her, and she kind of runs away. And then she meets Sam, and it goes from there. But it's very good. And actually, the director, Kate Shortland, has a new movie coming out this year. That's like her first movie since then. So that should be one to look for. It's called Lore. First movie in 8 years. So
Nice. Because I'm so stupid, you said the title. And I googled Summer Space Salt. As in the...
Like a spice that you would use in the summer. Yeah.
And I just couldn't get anything. So
I'm going to make a movie called Somersault just to aid in that confusion for future generations.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to break our pantomime here, the pretending that we don't know The Dark Knight is coming out. As we all know, The Dark Knight Rises is coming out next week.
What?
I know. It snuck up on you. I mean, there's been no promotion for this.
I didn't think Nolan was going to do a third.
Yeah, he lied.
Is Heath Ledger in it?
Yes, he is.
Oh, okay.
They did that thing that they did to Laurence Olivier for Gladiator.
I was actually making a joke about the fact that he's dead.
That was really, well, Laurence Olivier was dead, too. They just used shadows and composites. Anyway, unimportant.
I'm not happy he's dead or something. It was a tragic death. It happened 4.5 years ago. We can make a joke.
No, yeah, no, definitely.
Okay.
I'm not telling you. I am no, you know, I'm gonna step on your free speech type of guy. You know, if you wanna make any kind of joke, that's fine with me. I'm not gonna heckle you like Daniel Tosh. But no. So and you know, I know a lot of people are watching Batman Begins and The Dark Knight again, and I said fuck that, and I decided to watch The Prestige. And damn, that's still a good movie.
Yeah.
Like, really fantastic movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of these movies where it's not a spoiler to say something has a twist ending. I mean, it's a freaking magic movie. Like, you know there's going to be some kind of twist. The entire movie's predicated on the idea of a magic trick. And it's one of the few movies where that twist isn't just, like, clever, but it actually really throws the rest of the film into a very stark relief.
Mm-hmm.
And watching it again, knowing where it's going, is a very fulfilling and enriching experience. I watched it on Blu-ray. As with all of Nolan's films, it's just gorgeous. Like, yeah. Wally Pfister is just a friggin' incredible cinematographer. Like, I don't know. It's one of his least talked about films. But honestly, if I were to rank his films, I think it might, for me, come above The Dark Knight.
I mean, that's a fair choice. Yeah, I think it has the slight misfortune of... It came out a year after Batman Begins and
then
about,
was immediately preceded by The Dark Knight.
Yeah, it was sort of... I feel like if, you know, say he made something else between those two and then that came out after The Dark Knight instead of, like, Inception or something.
Right.
Then people,
yeah, that would have been interesting.
Not just because it's more recent, but I feel like it's after Nolan has achieved that breakthrough, if you will.
Yeah.
Because when The Prestige came out, a lot of people still didn't know... A lot of normal people still didn't know who Christopher Nolan was.
Yeah.
You know? And, I guess a lot of people still don't, but his name carries more weight now.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, after The Batman Begins wasn't a huge hit, you know, the scale of The Dark Knight, obviously. But, you know, you could put the director of The Dark Knight on Inception and get asses in the seat. You know, you couldn't say the director of Batman Begins for The Prestige and get the same amount of people.
They did, though. But they didn't get the same amount of people.
Right, right, exactly. But no, I think it's definitely a movie worth checking out. It's really good. Excellent performances by Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale and Michael Caine. It sounded like you were gearing up to say something.
Oh, I'm going to rewatch that movie soon, but I feel like there's one scene, one moment that's been ruined for me forever because one time I was over the apartment of Jordan and Dan, and they were watching The Prestige. And do you remember the scene where he's showing the gun to his wife, played by Rebecca Hall, Christian Bale?
Yes.
And he says, "Someone could put a bullet down there." Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Well, Dan immediately said, "Hugh Jackman could put a bullet down there. You know, the man who hates me, wants to ruin my life, could put a bullet down there." And I just feel like when I watch it again, that's going to...
That's going to be there in your mind.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That'll probably get edited out of the thing.
No. All right.
I don't know. I don't know if that's a spoiler. Eh, fuck it. I'll leave it in.
That's not a spoiler at all. The whole movie is predicated upon the idea that they're dueling magicians.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. I almost go on the assumption that someone seeing a movie has absolutely no fucking idea what the movie is about. Anyway.
The movie's been out for almost 6 years.
I don't care. But yeah, it has been out for almost 6 years. But it like I said, it holds up great. It's a fantastic film. That is the end of today's discussion. However, for anyone who stuck around this long, good work, first of all, for sticking with us. I appreciate your completionist work ethic. I wanted to tell you that next week, when we review The Dark Knight Rises, we will also be having a Blu-ray giveaway.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. A little bit of prize action going on. So you should definitely tune in, not only to hear us give our opinions on probably the most highly anticipated film of the year. I think that's fair to say, right?
For some people.
For some people. You're not going to qualify that?
No.
You don't want to say what kind of people?
No, no.
What are you trying to say, Nick?
No, I'm saying it's not personally my most anticipated movie of the year, but for some people it is.
Okay, all right.
Overall, it's
a fair general statement.
Yeah, I would say that it's a fair general statement. I would say a plurality of people would say that they were most anticipating this film. But yeah, so you should join us for that, and I will also be giving away a Blu-ray. I will not tell you a Blu-ray of what, though. It's not going to be a shitty movie. I mean, I'm not going to try to foist something like Twilight on you. So don't worry about that. But yeah, Blu-ray giveaway. Awesome. So come back next week when we talk about The Dark Knight Rises and we give away a Blu-ray. And before we go, Nick, why don't you tell us where we can find more of your stuff on the internet?
Well, my writings are at thefilmstage.com, and you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
Danny?
TheKingBulletin.com, twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And you can find me at deerfilm.net and twitter.com/BrianJRowan. And remember, don't forget to comment and leave a rating on iTunes, and do send us an email if you have something interesting to say. Or if you're bored, we're here for you, either way. Thanks for joining us, and come back next week. And starring Kuvenzane Wallace. Kuvenzane, right?
Don't laugh at her name.
I'm trying. I'm laughing at my inability to say it the same way two times in a row. Kuvenzane Wallace. That Kuvenzane. God damn it. I thought that young Miss Wallace.
This movie strives so hard to be in the what do you call it? Someone?
Zeitgeist?
Not the zeitgeist. the pit. Is that a thing? Let's edit this out. Edit this out.
You just like to make up analogies and metaphors and idioms.
All right. Let's start over. Okay. See, this is good. This is a good way to state my opinion, is completely screwing it up. All right.